Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 78, section 6, which is old single column, page 873. Okay, recall the preceding section, we got the sweep through majority of the Andite migrations over many, 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 many millennia. And at the very end, that last paragraph of section 5, they were giving you a little tease about the final 2,000 years from 8,000 to 6,000 BC, which they want to now focus on more detail. There's the final waves where they're towards the end here, in many ways, as we'll see, they're being basically driven out of Mesopotamia, as opposed to going out with a plan to benefit others, who need some biologic uplift. We're way down the road from that. It's not so much in that consciousness stemming from Adam and Eve and the biologic uplift. They're just a people that are living in Mesopotamia now with little tidbits of memory of ancient history. The hordes are getting more and more aggressive all the time. And so the writing's on the wall for them being able to maintain any sort of isolated integrity between the two rivers. So that's the state we're in. Trying to think if there's anything else. The kind of the main point that you get as you come out of section 5, recall that because of that heightened directional, in contrast to place-like consciousness, that the Adamic blood gave mankind, it was very much active in those Andites, with that directional sense about themselves, they went in every direction to the horizon and beyond. So they even penetrated all the way across the Pacific, island hopping, before the ocean went up as much as it is now, and made it all the way to South America. With a handful of them, 132 of them. Basically everyone either got quite a bit of biologic impact, or at the very least, a very, very consequential cultural impact from the Andites. The world has been seeded like that. And we just have the final little story to tell now of what about those last groups and what focus did they have specifically to sort of put the final cherries on top of this Andite Sunday. Okay.
In a world without a rebellion and a default, what? This is. I'm just asking you to speculate.
Mm-hmm.
What amount of Adamic inheritance do you think the end result of most of the population might be?
Would it
be more like these Andite peoples?
It's a good question. I suppose that just kind of off the top of my head, they probably would be looking for, a very, very managed Sangic peoples, colored race peoples, so that combined with a very extensive buildup of pureline Adamites, so that you get, in many ways, you would get, sort of this best of Andite sort of level, I would think, for a final people. I don't know. It's kind of difficult to think about, you would base a more specific answer on just off the top of my head. But I guess based upon what we have here, they definitely tell you that when you have an Andite in this 1/8 to 1/6 range, you had enough Adamic blood to very definitively activate that directional nature that I was just referring to, but not quite enough to balance it out then. But the thing is, that's a statement relative to our very unmanaged Sangic population and how that blended in. So, I'm not quite sure exactly how to think that through. But I would, my gut feeling would be that you wouldn't have a very diluted Adamic blood, because you're basically wanting to have an activation of all those potentials in the Sangics, and enough Adamic blood to sort of actualize all that potential, and then, like I was just kind of saying, put the cream on top of that, with the pure Adamic blood, and really avoid a phenomenon where everything is being drugged down. You would manage it so there really isn't a dragging down. You're just feeding Adamic blood in, actualizing all the potential, and then, like I said, then put the cream on the top, so that you end up with a you basically end up with the best of what pure violet race has to offer, plus all that a violet race isn't, the actualized potentials of the Sangic people of that world.
Chris.
Okay.
So even that becomes an art form.
Yeah, it's an extreme art that the Adam and Eve apply to a world. It's different for every world. Right? So it's a, like you're saying, as you can tell, it's there's a lot of art to it, as well as science to it, to figure out just exactly how to do that, to manage the pop, so that you don't get too many of a particular Sangic stock, and who blends with whom when, and all that sort of thing.
Are they usually, the Sangics usually blended before
that? Yeah, that's another point there. There would be a lot of management of that blending. I mean, just before an Adam and Eve arrive, even though the prince and his staff aren't directly focused on these genetic issues, because there's still so much evolution, in play, and especially in the early days of a prince's regime. But they definitely are encouraging the initial blending, so that you have some managed blended stock prior to the Adam and Eve arriving. It's an interesting question here, like we talk about all the time. We have this pre-blended race of the Andonites, so that throws a whole different twist into it here. You don't have to blend that which is already effectively blended, but it's very minimalized, and so how would that... we don't know exactly how it was supposed to be done here. It would have been an exception to a number of rules, I suspect, in exactly how they would have done it here relative to a normal world. But I think, what I was saying, that that's probably the best you can do, is a basic intuition on it, to avoid what we're seeing here, where the numbers of sanghiks are just too great. Even with them holding this for thousands and thousands of years and pouring out by the millions, it just, everything is just inexorably being dragged down. Your uplift has a high degree of relativity to it. I'm sure the idea is to not have it so definitively like that, to kind of bring the sanghiks up, you know, and then engage them rather than engaging them in a state where they're just going to drag you down as a violet race. And recall again, just up front, you know, so we're doing this last little bit, 8,000 to 6,000 BC, and you know, that 6,000 BC again, that's the beginning of recorded history. That's our first benchmark that we're trying to get up to in this tale of the Andites. You know, it's the answer to that question, well, what happened before recorded history? And so we're getting that final piece that gives us that, sets it up precisely in the state that we sort of know from recorded history. You know, obviously, back to 6,000 BC, it isn't an extensive record, but we have, you know, tidbits from that far back. Okay, let's see what we got.
Section 6, the last Andite dispersions. The last three waves of Andites poured out of Mesopotamia between 8,000 and 6,000 BC. These three great waves of culture were forced out of Mesopotamia by the pressure of the hill tribes to the east and the harassment of the plainsmen of the west. The inhabitants of the Euphrates Valley and adjacent territory went forth in their final exodus in several directions.
Okay, so before you go into those, let's just think about the little preface there. And so we're getting into the tail end of the Stone Age now with the, you know, the New Stone Age, the Neolithic, and so you see how that ties in with them indicating that there's this final bit of upliftment that's going to happen, you know, that is driving sort of the last bit of primitive Stone Age culture out of mankind, you know, and setting the stage for things going forward into the Bronze Age and the Iron Age eventually. And these last three waves, they don't tell you right there, but remember we were kidding about it last week when we were talking about this. Where's the horses? In these last three waves, they're mainly going much more rapidly up because, in general, they're going on horseback now. Okay. So they're going to, when we talk about them going over to Europe, you know, where they have to, that long trek of sweeping up along the eastern side of the Caspian Sea and wrapping around and going over into northern Europe, they can do that on horseback now. And so just go screaming around the Caspian Sea, you know, and across the plains over to Europe. So that's what's going out here. But you can see, these, you know, they say these three great waves of culture were forced out of Mesopotamia because you're getting increasing pressure from the peoples to the northeast that we read about earlier that got upstepped by those earlier waves of Andites, but you know they get drugged down by blending into all the evolutionary peoples, you know, so they're, you know, basically barbarian mentality but they're very energized, and they have horses, and you know, the salts of this, you know, of it washing back upon the Mediterranean or picking up, you know, coming down through what's now Iran. And then the harassment of the plainsmen from the west, the Arabs, are getting more and more aggressive, and you know, and able to make inroads into Mesopotamia. You know, they'll take control of things for a while, and finally they're driven out again. And then, you know, so it's starting to get dicey, where the culture there in Mesopotamia is it's not only declining, but it's starting to sputter, and you know, you kind of lose it, and then the, you know, then you regain it, and you lose it and regain it as it's, as these assaults are getting more and more effective from both sides. Okay, and let's see. Okay, so because of that, those sort of final, which are going to, you know, bring the end about pressures, you have these final waves that go out. So what? Let's see how they break down.
65% entered Europe by the Caspian Sea route to conquer and amalgamate with the newly appearing white races, the blend of the blue men and the earlier Andites.
So by the time that you get these final waves, you kind of have a white race now, you could say. It's gotten to, you know, there's enough Andite is fed in there that it's washed the color out of the Sangic stock there. And you can say that you have a primitive, you know, an early, this is a very early white race in Europe. And, you know, you don't even have to read the rest. It's like, obviously, most of them went there, 65%. So that, you know, most of the cherry on the top phenomenon, see, is to Europe. And you know, we already read that you had huge amounts that went there in the first place. So that dragging the Andite genetics down, even though it was drugged down, it was as minimally drugged down as it was on anywhere on the planet, just because of the huge numbers that went in there. You know, it obviously sets up a latent situation that we know began to actualize definitively once mankind got out of the Middle Ages. And the spear point of civilization really awoke in Europe and penetrated over to where we're sitting right now. Okay? Because again, it's only that Andite genetics, you know, and it may lie dormant for a long time before it's awakened, but it's only that Andite genetics that gives you anything that you can definitively call civilization. If you're going to get a people that aren't technically barbaric, you know, that are going to be semi-civilized, there has to be biologic uplift. It's just at best barbaric when it's just Sangic. Okay, that's the key. And whenever a Sangic, even if it isn't literally genetic, wherever a Sangic mentality begins to take a hold of a people again, no matter what the color of their skin is, you're going to lose that civilization. It's going to take on natural barbaric form again. You know, religion, for instance, you know, by and large, religion on the planet is the religion of barbarians. You know, that's you know, even with all of the epical revelations, there's just so much Sangic culture that the religion gets drugged down. And we talked about that last time. That's the most unnatural thing we do, is genuinely relate to the inner life and genuinely have some sort of religion, genuinely have some relationship to genuine spirit substance, and not just fancy feelings about matter. So, the fact that mankind doesn't have any proper recognition of another substance in the external world called spirit, it means that inescapably, you know, even the best of religion on the planet is going to be essentially barbaric religion. And just little tinges, say, because of, you know, what Jesus did 2,000 years ago, say, where it's a little bit more of that, you know, in some modes. But we all know that how quickly even the apostles lost track of Jesus trying to bump it above the barbaric level, and had a tendency to just put the new wine in the old barbaric wineskins. Okay, so so it's just the previous pattern continued, and that's why, again, when you say, well, what was the complexion of the violet race like? Well, it obviously must be very, very fair-skinned, because we look at where most of it ended up, and that's why we have lily-white people in Northern Europe. It just washes, they don't really have any coloration of their own, so it just washes out all of the evolutionary coloration the more you put into it. Now, they tell you, on a normal world, you have enough Sangic blended in that you have a definite color to the people of a world. You know, they're not lily white skin on a normal world when all is said and done. But it's like I said. I mean, you make sure that you bring the Sangic people and their skin color, that comes along for the ride, up to a very high level, and you activate it in a way where things are going to get drugged down. So you get this very uplifted people, but you have a lot of skin color that goes upward for the with the process, comes along for the ride. That just kind of reminds you that those normal people, when Adam and Eve, when the Adam and Eve on the world are done with them, are definitely not lily white people. So thinking that just because you're lily white, you're some advanced mind, is a very poor assumption. Okay.
Kind of tricky. Designing resurrection halls for these special cases.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to tweak this a bit.
All right. Let's see. Anything else? I think we got that. Yeah. What's the next little group here?
10%, including a large group of the Sethite priests, moved eastward through the Elamite highlands to the Iranian plateau in Turkestan. Many of their descendants were later driven into India with their Aryan brethren from the regions to the north.
Okay, so you had some. Their thought is, instead of going north, let's do what's been done for a long time. If things get difficult between the rivers, you can scurry eastward across the Tigris, to Elam, to Susa, basically, and then from there, work your way up, the Zagros Mountains and, into the Iranian Plateau area. So you did have a group that had that Yeah, it's like, well, let's go that way. We sort of, there's a well-worn, at least beginning of a path that way, see, straight east into Elam. So some of them did that. Interesting, see that you got, they mentioned that you had a lot of that Sethite mentality that went that way, and then point out how that gets shoved, you know, into northern India, so that feeds into Brahmanism and whatnot in India eventually.
Okay. Yep. I'm kind of struck, even though they were able warriors, they were really, it strikes me, they were Pacific type people. They weren't really war. They really weren't that militant.
Yeah, I mean, see, and that's, it's not, a lot of that is just cultural there between the rivers. They could be militaristic, but they were, there was a lot of choice to be Pacific people. And that once those peoples, though, got outside of that immediate culture with that sort of constant reinforcement to not be sort of you know, offensively militaristic. You know, they were had to be defensively militaristic all the time, you know, to protect themselves, but to not be offensively militaristic. As soon as they got out of that, they definitely picked up on the offensive militarism, and that's, like I was saying, that's a problem, especially when the ones that went to the northeast, you know, they end up turning around and then attacking, you know, the Pacific peoples between the rivers, the high-minded people between the rivers, and you got this golden rulers being exterminated by the baser orders of humanity phenomenon. But they are smart enough not to sit there and be exterminated. It's like, okay, let's get out of here, just like Adam and Eve got out of the first garden. Like, oh, let's just leave it, you know.
Asking about moving out of my neighborhood.
Because the hordes are descending, or but see, the very fact that those peoples were coming back and, you know, with horses and attacking them, they then get the horse idea and start heading out on horses. So these barbarians coming at them with horses teach them about horses and, you know, the benefits of horses, and they pick up on that. They're not stupid, and so they skedaddle at high speed on horses. Okay, let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? Next little block.
10% of the Mesopotamians turned eastward in their northern trek, entering Sinkiang, where they blended with the Andite yellow inhabitants. The majority of this, the able offspring of this racial union, later entered China and contributed much to the immediate improvement of the northern division of the yellow race.
Okay, we'll get to that right away when we get to the next paper. We've already mentioned that. It had already started, you know, we talked about how it had already gotten started in the previous millennia with their migrations. So you had yellow men, a lot of them not going all the way to the east, but just going a little bit east, so they're in Sinkiang. And then the Andites coming out of Mesopotamia and bonding on top of that genetics, so that you have, see, Andite hyphen yellow. Yellow is the foundation with Andite on top of it, and now you're going to bring in even more andite on top of that, so that you're going to get a quite definitive civilizational mentality embedded there in Sinkiang that's going to penetrate into further eastward and produce the civilization of northern China, and that very definitive differential between North and South China. You know, that's, again, that's because of the Andites. You know, it's, you know, your first thought might be, well, maybe the differential North-South is there's more pure yellow men in northern China, and the secondary Sangiks were coming into southern China, Indochina and stuff, and is that caused a differential? Yeah, that gives you a north-south differential in China, but the big differential is caused by injecting Andites into the north. Much more than the difference between primary and secondary Sangiks, because it's the difference between Andites, right, and Sangiks of any stripe. Okay, so if you ever wondered why, those initial seats of Chinese civilization were in the north, that's why. They're just going straight east from Sin Kang over into northern China. All right, let's see. Anything else there? No, I think I got it there. Okay, and then one little tiny thing here.
10% of these fleeing Andites made their way across Arabia and entered Egypt.
So despite all of the hordes in Arabian Peninsula there to the west of the Mesopotamia, at least in the when those ragtag tribes couldn't get themselves very organized, you could penetrate through them and get over to Egypt. And of course, we all know that produces the whole story in Egypt. Again, you don't have all the fancy civilizational stuff in Egypt because there were Sangic peoples there that did incredible things that they don't tend to do now. No, it's Andites. It's only Andites. If there weren't Andites, there wouldn't be pyramids or anything like that, because there wouldn't be Imhotep. Right? And that's all because of the Andites. All right, and then the final little tidbit here that we'll get to at the end of the paper here.
5% of the Andites, the very superior culture of the coastal district about the mouths of the Tigris and Euphrates, who had kept themselves free from intermarriage with inferior neighboring tribesmen, refused to leave their homes. This group represented the survival of many superior Nadite and Adamite strains.
So the same thing is still going on. Remember way back when the Nadites first started scattering around, we had the quote-unquote pre-Sumerian Nadites. Well, now we have the Sumerians, right? Think about how incredibly potent the fact that the planetary headquarters was there. I mean, even 500,000 years later, it is still motivating a people to stay right there at the sacred place where Dalmatia kind of sort of used to be, or as close to it as they could be. It's very, very potent influence. Even if we lost all of the details from the prince's staff because of the rebellion, the fact that the planetary headquarters was there, no one forgot. And so the most significant thing that dawns on the beginning of recorded history is the Sumerians, and you might wonder, well, why are they there? Why aren't they somewhere else on the planet? It's because that's where the planetary headquarters was, right? And, you think that Jerusalem has an attracting influence for people, in terms of their imagination. Think about Dalmatia. We'll see if people are still fixated on Jerusalem 500,000 years later, like they were 500,000 years later with Dalmatia.
Only because Jesus was there might be.
Right. And of course, Jesus, going there is just to play into the fixation on, that Machaventus started. We have a sense because of Jerusalem and other places on the planet of sacred locations. And these Sumerians are holding. They will not move. They refuse to leave their homes. And as we'll see as we get forward a little bit, they saw to it that they had the most sophisticated defenses, and they had the wisdom to make themselves useful, and so that, you know, the barbarians said, you know, I think maybe we won't just kill them all. I think they might be handy. Why don't we keep them around for teachers? And so it goes all the way to Jesus' time with Chaldea. Right? I mean, that's what finally. Yeah. So yeah, it took until very recently before you finally washed away the last focusing influence of civilization there. The three kings didn't come from Central America. Right, they came from this sacred spot. Right, they were Chaldeans. They were post-Sumerians. They were post-Andites. They were post-post-Andites. They were post-post-post-Nodites. They were right. You know, they were the last vestiges of remembering that the planetary headquarters was there. Okay, so it's like the planetary headquarters sending ambassadors to welcome, the creator son to our world. It's the evolutionary best we could do to that effect.
Yep. So you use the word, I think, imagination. Describing those two places, and I got to go to Israel, the 2000th birthday of Jesus. When I got to Jerusalem, there were two buses, 75 people on the Urantia group, and they dropped us off on the Mount of Olives. We got to sleep there at that hotel, Romulus International Hotel. Well, I just got off the bus and walked out because they had these little pods sticking out on the edge. And you're looking right at the sunset that's going down over Jerusalem.
Over the Dome of the Rock.
I went out there and wept by myself for at least 30 to 45 minutes. And the draw that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. Someone who's like you, who's experienced how powerful Jerusalem is, it just... you can understand these Andites that refuse to leave, because every time they think about Dalmatia, they weep, just like you couldn't help but weep when you thought about this is where the master was 2,000 years ago. They still had that powerful emotional attachment to that place. As best they could after 500,000 years, they were still holding on to, memories of the glory days. We're all emotional creatures, and we are deeply moved by remembering those sort of founding facts. Of our nature, right? If you identify strongly with Jesus, you just can't help but identify with where he walked. No matter where you're born on the planet, you inescapably have a bond to that location on the planet. Back to this.
You can imagine what the culture would be on this planet if we hadn't had the default and never done because everybody would be like going there and enjoying this.
You think it's cool to go to Europe and it's like, wow, this This house was built 1,000 years ago or something. It's like, imagine going to a place you knew was set up hundreds of thousands of years ago. All right. Okay. So that's how it broke down. 95% went out and blended in, and 5% stayed to the bitter end. Eventually did blend in, but they are there petering out. Biologically they're petering out about 2000 BC, but culturally it hadn't totally petered out. Even when Jesus was alive. All right, what else they say here?
The Andites had almost entirely evacuated this region by 6000 BC, though their descendants, largely mixed with the surrounding Sangic races and the Andonites of Asia Minor, were there to give battle to the northern and eastern invaders at a much later date.
Okay, so what they're referring to there is what I was just hinting at 2 seconds ago, and what they hinted at way back at the beginning of the paper. Remember the last little statement in the preface of this paper? They talked about taking the story to about 2000 BC. They said the Andite peoples, starting in 15,000 BC and on to its final disappearance from the Mesopotamian homelands about 2000 BC. And we talked about how, that's right before Machiavelli and Melchizedek arrived, so it's taking the second epical revelation up to the beginning of the third. Yes, there's that, but also there's just what they're mentioning here. You basically have the Andites out of, as Andites, out of Mesopotamia at the beginning of recorded history at 6000 BC. From 6000 to 2000 BC, as they're saying there, you have a residual phenomenon there that's has much more blending, so it's not technically Andite anymore. But they are still holding on to the location and its culture, indifferential to the barbarians. But eventually that all gets washed away, and you begin sort of officially Babylonia at about 2000 BC. Okay? So that's what they're hinting at there, that much later date is taking you down those 4,000 years to about 2000 BC, when the transition is sort of fully made, and you just don't have a Sumerian or post-Sumerian culture. The outside culture comes in and takes over, and you set up Babylonia. But, like I was hinting at, they don't totally wipe out that group that stayed down at the bottom, and so you end up with the Chaldean region of Babylonia, right, as you go forward to Jesus' time. All right, so that's what they're hinting at there. You can kind of see between the lines there, as they're indicating that you've got these, these people coming in, and it's getting more mixed. They're not really keeping the boundaries solid anymore. But one of the positive things I already hinted at of that cultural engagement is, that's the horse. That's a cool idea. Let's do that too. And so, so you just sort of had this transference of the horse culture, because of this conquering mentality, into Mesopotamia, and then out it went to the whole world via those last waves of Andites, across the Atlantic Ocean and on to North America. All right, what else do they have here?
The culture of the second garden was terminated by the increasing infiltration of the surrounding inferior stocks. Civilization moved westward to the Nile and the Mediterranean islands, where it continued to thrive and advance long after its fountainhead in Mesopotamia had deteriorated. And this unchecked influx of inferior peoples prepared the way for the later conquest of all Mesopotamia by the northern barbarians who drove out the residual strains of ability. Even in later years, the cultured residue still resented the presence of these ignorant and uncouth invaders.
The Chaldeans, right? Resenting these barbarians. It was this issue of barbarians. It's not just, at the end of the story, say, where you, like I said, in advance of 2000 BC, technically, we've had these barbarians creeping in for several thousand years. That's the, so you have a ramping up of barbarians and a ramping down of, a civilized to semi-civilized people stemming down from the second garden. Okay. But fortunately, civilization picked up and moved westward. As I said, good thing, or, there wouldn't be anyone sitting in this room today to read a fifth epical revelation if it hadn't gone over to Egypt and over to the Mediterranean islands and into Greece and into Rome and into Europe and over to America. Okay. All right. So now we have, we're going to tell a little bit of the story that's there, sometimes in a little bit confused and reworked fashion at the beginning of our recorded history. What about some of those earliest stories that are in the Bible? What about that flood story, for instance? Is there something real to that, or is that just something that was just totally invented out of nothing by the Jewish leaders when they were in exile in the 6th century B.C.? Let's see.
Section 7, the floods in Mesopotamia. The river dwellers were accustomed to rivers overflowing their banks at certain seasons. These periodic floods were annual events in their lives. But new perils threatened the valley of Mesopotamia as a result of progressive geologic changes to the north.
Okay, so we're going to pick up that geologic story that we've, remember that's been going on quite definitively. The first garden started going under about 32,000 BC. Remember, 34,000 years ago, we figured that out. So about 32,000 BC. So all of those millennia up to 6,000 BC, obviously there's been a lot of continuing activity. As they're about to mention specifically in the next paragraph, it's a very active geologic region still today. There's lots of earthquakes in that immediate region. And so things are being shoved up. And that's going to obviously cause changes in climate in those regions and changes in the periodic flooding patterns. So what are the details here?
For thousands of years after the submergence of the first Eden, the mountains of the eastern coast of the Mediterranean and those of the northwest and northeast of Mesopotamia continued to rise. This elevation of the highlands was greatly accelerated around 5000 BC. And this, together with greatly increased snowfall on the northern mountains, caused unprecedented floods each spring throughout the Euphrates Valley. These spring floods grew increasingly worse, so that eventually the inhabitants of the river regions were driven to the eastern highlands. For almost 1,000 years, scores of cities were practically deserted because of these extensive deluges.
Okay, so we've talked about this, how unsettled the climate was up until recorded history times. But I always throw in the little qualifier that first millennium from 6,000 B.C. to 5,000 B.C., as you can see here, had a lot of unsettled, even a little bit into that. But, you know, I'm speaking in general, things were settling down. But you still had some local unsettledness that was definitely driving people around. We already saw how some of them, when they were being driven by the barbarians out of Mesopotamia, went east into Elam. See, they have the same immediate idea here. They scurry over to Susa, basically, across the Tigris to the east, and are kind of headquartered there for about 1,000 years, because this is too complicated to live literally between the rivers. Yeah. So there certainly was, way back there, a very definitive, upsetting flood phenomenon. But that's a long time before, say, Babylonians are writing things down. So, there's, you know, people are going to lose track of the details, but there's going to be the idea of a disruptive flood carrying forward in stories. You know, and undoubtedly, when people try to write something down, like the Sumerian Kings List, they're going to put the flood in their story, but it's going to be some more recent disruptive flooding event that's going to be the flood. And, and they're going to have some sort of attempt to stretch the long distance back from that flood to effectively Adam and Eve coming down from the heavens. And so when you look at these stories, these recorded stories that mention a flood, you know, don't go, well, the Urantia book tells us exactly when that is. No, you can't do that, because it's, you know, very likely that this is some subsequent event that's gotten recast, right, as the flood. You know, and it may be, only in the third millennium BC, say. Right. But the pattern was set, if you will, in storytelling, much further back, with this big event. You notice that you had the same effect way back that got the Ice Age started. You had all those incredible highlands up in the northern part of the planet, where it started snowing and kept snowing until the ice was coming, you know, across the continents in sheets. You start shoving stuff up, and you get a lot more snow on it. So that, you know, we actually are shoving those mountains to the north of the Fertile Crescent up enough that, it's significantly increasing the melting in the spring. All right. Let's see. Oh, and the other thing to think about, like I've pointed out, what's happening somewhere in that 6,000 to 5,000 BC range that we're kind of in now, is the Mediterranean is filling up the rest of the way. So any sort of a fringe of those people that have been driving, you know, been driven up that used to live way down in the Mediterranean basin, and it's up to basically current levels. Water flows up the Bosphorus, fills up the Black Sea. So you now, you know, we're in a state where the geography is basically what you see today. Okay, with the Mediterranean and the Black Sea basically as they are today. But it is kind of, you know, difficult to imagine. It's not that long ago. It was very, very different. Imagine how different it would look if there weren't a Black Sea. Imagine how unappealing Crimea would be to Russians if there wasn't a Black Sea, for instance. Right? It'd be a very different geopolitical situation if that hadn't filled up with water. Yep.
And all the flooding, there's physical evidence of all that.
Yeah, I mean, in recent years, they've begun to discover some of this evidence, like with the Black Sea filling up and those sorts of things. It's obviously difficult because a lot of it gets washed away and hard to track. You know, it's difficult to explore underwater. That just makes it, you know, and the Black Sea is very opaque. It's very difficult to do research there and stuff, but nonetheless, we're slowly figuring out some of these things. And that's why you notice the Revelators don't give you those details, because they wouldn't have been allowed to, because we can figure that out. It's taking us a long time, but we're slowly figuring this stuff out.
And Google Earth, too.
What was that?
Google Earth.
Yeah, not to mention, you know, our very, very hands-on engagement of the globe now from satellites, and you know we can focus in detail on things now like we couldn't in the past. Yeah, technology is getting us there. All right, but just, you know, the final little thing. For almost 1,000 years, scores of cities were practically deserted. I mean, again, it's not like the planetary government said, "Oh my goodness, we need to intervene and prevent all this disruption because of climate changes." No, right? I mean, that's just part of the process. That's why you were given a mind to adapt to changes. So again, you just over and over, they're trying to give us some perspective on this. Now, if it rains more one year than it did the previous year, we think the world's coming to an end.
I'm just picturing these people, you know, year after year, coming back to their homes and shoveling out the mud, and starting all over again. It's like after hundreds of years, you think, oh, is it just not really worth it anymore?
Right, so that's why I said, okay, let's just move over in a little higher ground for a while, you know. But, you know, just the fact that you can tell by the way they say it, they didn't think, well, let's just abandon this. It's like, no, let's temporarily move for the next 1,000 years over there. And that's the kind of long, you know, because they've been there for 500,000 years. So they, you know, 1,000 years is just a temporary displacement for them. All right.
Almost 5,000 years later, as the Hebrew priests in Babylonian captivity sought to trace the Jewish people back to Adam, they found great difficulty in piecing the story together, and it occurred to one of them to abandon the effort, to let the whole world drown in its wickedness at the time of Noah's flood, and thus to be in a better position to trace Abraham right back to one of the three surviving sons of Noah.
Ah, a handy plot device. So that, but you can, it's like I was saying, there, you know, and we haven't gotten to, you know, but it's obvious, there really was a Noah, not the Noah in the Bible, not a, you know, whatever time it appears to be happening in the Bible or anything. All it is, but it's all predicated on events that occurred long ago and are coming forward in, you know, in stories and through oral tradition. And they hear those stories in Babylonia, you know, of people remembering way back to these times, and retell the story to suit their plot. Okay, and see, and like I say, it's not just those Hebrews doing that. You know, anything that you find written that mentions a flood is going to be some kind of retelling to fit their ends, right? So you have to keep that in mind. It's going to be difficult for you to find anyone talking about a flood that is literally this flood. It's going to be some subsequent thing that, you know, where there wasn't a flood at that time at all. It's just a part of the story, or there was some lesser flooding and, you know, that disrupted things, and that becomes the flood in the story. All right. And you notice the biggie thing about the Bible story is the whole wickedness thing and stuff. And you can see that's all just, you know, pulled out of thin air. See, there isn't any predicate for that. And of course that's where those Hebrew leaders are getting that is, you know, they're the chosen people. And everyone else is wicked by definition. All right, so how about a little bit more about what actually happened way back when?
The traditions of a time when water covered the whole of the earth's surface are universal. Many races harbor the story of a worldwide flood sometime during past ages. The biblical story of Noah, the ark, and the flood is an invention of the Hebrew priesthood during the Babylonian captivity. There has never been a universal flood since life was established on Urantia. The only time the surface of the earth was completely covered by water was during those Archaeozoic ages before the land had begun to appear.
Yeah, remember when we were way back in the historical geology papers? Yeah, you go back to a billion years ago, which has a radiometric date of 4 billion years ago. Yeah, so that's what scientists would call 4 billion years ago. All right, but you go back a billion years ago to the beginning of the Archaeozoic, and you had a global ocean. There was no land at all. But it's never been like that since. Once you got land, you kept land. But it is interesting, see, that it's not, you know, they're reminding you, as I just said, it's not just the Hebrews dreaming up this handy plot device story. Everyone is fascinated by this idea of a universal flood. So major flooding, you know, occurs all over the planet. It obviously makes a lasting impact on people because it was very disruptive. You know, it was like their whole world was underwater. Right? Everything they knew was underwater. And it makes this very enduring impact, and it feeds into stories everywhere. It isn't like this flood story in Mesopotamia got spread by Andites all over the world. Obviously, that happened some, but more, it's just it repeats locally. There's some huge disruptive flood event. It makes this lasting impact on the people and forever colors their storytelling. You know, it becomes the fulcrum about which the story leverages, you know, for whatever ends they have, you know, in the story they're telling. So that's kind of interesting that we're so enduringly impacted by major floods. In terms of our storytelling, our imagination is so impacted by it. Let's see. You got some?
Well, I can't help but feel a bit of embarrassment that the revelers felt they had to make this definitive statement. Couldn't we figure that out on our own? Apparently not.
Okay, I'll digress for just a moment. I was tempted to do it a minute ago. Now I definitely will. Right. On the one hand, you can sit here and look down your nose from your high perch, you know, and mock these people, like say those Hebrews that, you know, could put out a story that the entire globe was covered in water and people believed it for centuries. And no sober scientist would ever believe some silly thing like that today. Okay, I mean, because scientists are so reactionary to people who used to believe the Bible literally, they don't literally believe in a global encompassment of water, liquid water, because that would be too much like the biblical flood. So, you know, they know they would get laughed out of the, you know, out of their organizations if they, you know, if they put forward that theory that the whole globe was covered with liquid water. But all the scientists think it's totally fine now to say that the entire Earth was encased in solid water many times, and all life didn't come to an end. So, see, again, it just shows you how we're naturally drawn to this story. And even when we create a whole reactionary, anti-church science phenomenon to get away from, you know, diluvian, antediluvian geology and all this sort of stuff, it comes back around again in the minds of barbaric so-called scientists. And they have their equivalent story, you know, where, you know, whatever godless forces rule their universe deemed that the entire planet needed to be cleansed by being encased in ice. Right? It's called the snowball earth theory. You know, and it started with belief and it happened one time and the entire earth was encased in ice. And then they found it so handy as a plot device, just like the Hebrews did, that they said, oh, let's do it more times. You know, every time we can't really put the pieces together like they couldn't, like they just said, let's just haul out that handy plot device and encase the earth in ice. Man, it's that ridiculous, that absurd, what now is being put forward by these people that are supposed to be so different from anyone who would believe the Noah story from the Bible. At least, in the Noah story in the Bible, there was a causal agent, you know, that produced it. You know, the magic man did it. Now we have to just believe that the magic matter did it. I digress.
Changes the design of the ark a little bit, too.
Yeah. I'm sure those stories will come around eventually. Yes. We'll have the equivalent Noah with his giant skidoo. All right. I hate to be so facetious, but it you know, it's just pitiful. I mean, when you just, you know, how can anyone believe these things? It's just ridiculous.
They've got all the religious trappings.
But again, it's just, I mean, how can we believe this? Because we're that primitive. I mean, it doesn't matter that we can, you know, go to the moon and make lasers and iPhones and all that stuff now. And in many ways, we're still a people that can believe these very primitive, superstitious, magical stories. Yeah.
More than that,
want to believe. And want to believe them, yeah, right, exactly. It somehow brings us comfort to believe these superstitious, magical stories. Yeah.
Confusion worse confounded.
Yeah, so anyway, meanwhile, back to Noah. Let's read about... remember how we saw that name, you know, that went way back to Adam and Eve's time? So there, this name was in use and has been going forward for millennia, you know, and is used for an individual back during these major flooding times.
But Noah really lived. He was a winemaker of Aram, a river settlement near Erech. He kept a written record of the days of the river's rise from year to year. He brought much ridicule upon himself by going up and down the river valley, advocating that all houses be built of wood, boat fashion, and that the family animals be put on board each night as the flood season approached. He would go to the neighboring river settlements every year and warn them that in so many days the floods would come. Finally, a year came in which the annual floods were greatly augmented by unusually heavy rainfall, so that the sudden rise of the waters wiped out the entire village. Only Noah and his immediate family were saved in their houseboat.
All right, so the world, and you know, engulfed in water, is that little village being completely engulfed in water, and this just gets aggrandized like every fish story as the story is told over the ensuing centuries.
Nobody there to say I told you so.
But you know, the real Noah, see, you know, see, he's obviously a very scientific minded individual.
Yeah.
He's keeping track of all this. I'm sure he's got, you know, measuring sticks where he's carefully monitoring, keeping a log of the water levels, just like we do today. And you know, how much is above flood stage, et cetera. You know, he's doing that same thing that we do.
Where are your critics, Noah? Looks like they're all
young. He was ridiculed.
And you can just imagine him, you know, out on his little evangelistic tours. You know, you need to make your house like a boat, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they're throwing rotten fruit at him. But sure enough, you know, he had the last laugh on that one.
Yeah.
You have that, the basic story, just forget about all the wickedness and all that sort of theologic stuff that the priests in the Babylonian captivity threw in. But the basic story all actually happened in truth, not in fact. It depends on who you talk to, how to pronounce all these Englishized versions of Sumerian city-state names, Erech or Erech or Uruk also. But that's one of the major Sumerian city-states, that one. And that even makes it into the Bible in Genesis. So it's not one of those big settlements that gets engulfed. It's this little village nearby that gets engulfed. That Aram name, Aram or Aram or however you want to say it, that's another name that goes forward in time and gets used for subsequent places and things. There's all of these kind of tidy little words. You know, that's one of the things we're learning here. A lot of them go way, way, way back before recorded history even and carry forward into the early stories in the Bible and stuff, and into early historical records. So it makes you wonder, you know, if they're coming from Andonite, you know, if they have some literal meaning in Andonite or something like that way, way back, or who knows what. What else did we have there? We got everything, didn't we? That whole bit about how he's a winemaker. it just reminds you of how cultured those people were. They weren't just knuckle-dragging, snarling people. There was a lot of sophistication to their culture.
Sounds like he had a lot of good science going on. I mean, he's mm-hmm. going to make some wine so his family can drink water and not die.
Yeah.
And he's
monitoring, you know, scientifically studying the flooding and the water. And
yeah, and see, all that's coming down from Adam and Eve. See, that whole mentality of thinking scientifically like that. You know how what scientists Adam and Eve were. See, so that's all that's coming down, all those millennia.
That curiosity gone.
You know, so that those who have that, you know, genetic tendency are, they lean into that and run with it, you know, because there's a culture that recognizes that. You know, if Albert Einstein had been born in, you know, the 9th century Viking culture or something, right? He wouldn't have been doing equals MC squared. He would have been wielding a battle axe or something, right? No.
Well, I was wondering, did any of these Andites have what we would recognize today as genius?
Yeah, sure. Right. Yeah. There would have been great geniuses amongst them, yeah. And that's kind of the point I was just making. You know, a genius might be there in potential, but it, you know, it can't actualize if there isn't the culture to foster it, right? I mean, you know, someone that, you know, if you had a record of it historically, it's like, well, there's an absolute nobody. You know, he was just cannon fodder. I mean, the reality was he was, you know, he might have been one of the most brilliant people that ever lived, but he didn't have a culture where that could have been actualized. And so he ended up, you know, just, you know, being a grunt soldier. You know, most of human history has been like that. It's only very recent times that individuals with genius have the opportunity to actually manifest that genius. So just think about the countless geniuses that were lost because there wasn't a culture there to, you know, for it to be able to manifest, as there should have been. See, if that's why the prince and his staff come, you know, basically as soon as you have will creatures, normally, so that they can be there to kind of catch the exceptional individuals and foster them and make sure they don't just get, you know, used as cannon fodder. That should have been the case for 500,000 years. That all of the genius, evolutionary genius, would have impacted civilization. I mean, I often think about, you know, what I, you know, I'm wondering what I would have been. Just, you know, you only have to go back a few centuries, and you know, any one of you would have been, could have done nothing like you've done with your life. You couldn't have been a, you know, musician like you are now, or something, right?
Couldn't be even seen very
well. Right. I mean, I would have died immediately in battle because I can't see 3 inches away from my nose. I mean, you know, it's all just, you know, so recent. Okay.
These floods completed the disruption of Andite civilization. With the ending of this period of deluge, the second garden was no more. Only in the south and among the Sumerians did any trace of the former glory remain.
Yeah, so see, yeah, you can see kind of what I was saying. So all over the globe, you've had this very disruptive, frequent climate change, constantly shoving people into different places, and you have sort of the last vestiges of that happening here in Mesopotamia. And then, you know, by and large, that sort of major disrupting phenomenon, you know, came to an end. And it's been relatively quiet for all these millennia. You know, so that civilization could, that the tenuous potential for civilization could actualize. You know, it's actually kind of interesting. I mean, if you'd had Adam and Eve not defaulting, long time ago, we would have been so robust, climate change would have been completely irrelevant. You know, we could have handled anything that the earth could dish out. You know, and you almost, and so it's like, yeah, but there was a default. And so coincidentally, there was a lull in extreme climate change so that we could kind of get it going, civilization going on our own without that robust help. Right, in supremacy, there are no coincidences. See, it all seems very curious. Like, well, Jesus, almost seems like it was fated that there was supposed to be a rebellion and a default. But of course not. It's not predestined. But it all works together, right? There needed to be a lull. And so coincidentally, there is a lull. It wasn't, and it's not a father-like intervention. It's not like some massive father-like hand intervened and stopped, you know, climate from changing radically. It's all just there in the evolutionary process because it's all an integrated system, coordinated system. And so there's always that coincidentally, quote unquote, that I'm always throwing out there. But there's no coincidences at all, really.
So similarly, if the weather drastically changes now, there are no coincidences, so maybe it's meant to be or something.
Yeah, I mean, everything is meant to be in an antecedent following way. Again, you know, the problem with saying meant to be is you're making time a reality. And see, you can help to appreciate how this is not so coincidental if you let go of time and just think of it. What we're experiencing, what it really is a downstepped expression of the eternal cosmos infinite. Right? And you know it's all infinitely, perfectly, completely coordinated. So when you downstep that, it inescapably has this wholeness to it that will manifest. You can't get out of the wholeness. The wholeness is superimposed upon it. The end is already in existence in eternity. Right, so the means to the end has this interesting conspiratorial character to it. It all works, right, in a very amazing, elaborate way.
Well, this area where the second garden was, even if it hadn't been for the default, when the first garden would have only lasted 4,000
years.
This area still was destined, I think, to be a civilizational center.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Dalmatia, the remnants of Dalmatia being at the southern end of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you notice, what do we call that area now? Iraq. What was that word that we just came by? Erech?
Yeah.
I wonder if that's a similar word. Yes, of course it is. Right, see, that name has come all the way down to today in modified form.
But anyway,
a whole bit about the just how delightful it is to know that there's a whole, right? And the wholeness of time isn't some afterthought, bottom up of time. The wholeness in time is eternity downstepped and superimposed upon time. You know, and is the ultimate reality of what's a confusing temporal tale. Okay. It should be very reassuring if you can just get a firm grip on that. That it all is inescapably encompassed in a coordinating hand of God the Mother. So, you know, that's the top-down influence. It's why the bottom-up parts aren't just randomly flying about, why there's a summation of those bottom-up parts. Right? They don't self-sum. Right? There's a coordinating influence that's superimposed upon them that sum them. Right? That coordinate them together into a sum. So that summation, that upwelling summation is the Almighty, you know, which is there because there's a downwelling focalization of the parts, the Mother.
Does mind have to do with it?
Yeah, and you can see the parallel of mind coming down, you know, and lifting your body parts up into a coordinated whole. They don't self-coordinate into a body. They're coordinated into a body by a downwelling influence, the mind. Right? It's the exact same pattern. Okay. Let's see, what else do we have there? We talked about the whole...
When you were talking, we read several paragraphs back, something about the evolution was unchecked. It said, they used the word unchecked.
Mm-hmm.
We know that this universe is mind-made and personality-managed, and so it being unchecked, it's not managed. It's unchecked.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, another way to...
You use the word unchecked.
right, I mean, it's a relative term. I mean, obviously everything is checked, in a sense, from what I was just describing. That downwelling influence conditions everything. Nothing can really fly off on an independent, part-wise tangent to the point where it disrupts the system. Everything is subservient to the whole, right? It's checked by the whole. Okay. So it's, you know, it's a relative term. I mean, it might be very locally, finitely unchecked, but it's not supremely unchecked. Right?
Point in case.
Yeah, yeah.
our rebellious, local system.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was easy to put that into check by the next notch up, the constellation putting a lid on it. You know, it was definitely checked. You might notice that was a checkmating of a out of control progress mentality in the local system. See, it's the same parallel between angels of progress and the religious guardians. Right, that same thing is in play there. Lucifer and crew, let's just progress like crazy, unchecked. No, you won't. Checkmate.
Right.
A
little while.
Right. Yeah, 2 years.
Two and three quarters.
Okay, back to here. Just note the one little, you know, we're talking about all of this disrupting influence and stuff. Okay, only in the South and among the Sumerians did any trace of the former glory remain. Again, we're going to get this more. Those people all the way to the South were the most sophisticated, and they could actually handle the flooding with all of their sophisticated setup, canals and stuff. You know, it's the less sophisticated people, a little bit more to the north. They go, let's just move out of here. Let's go to the east for a while. They not only are going to stay put, they have the means to stay put no matter what. Unprecedented flooding? No. Well, we've got that planned for already. Yeah, their foresight was great.
Plus the.
Yeah, they'll get to that. There's also the geographic issues like that, yes.
The remnants of this, one of the oldest civilizations, are to be found in these regions of Mesopotamia and to the northeast and northwest. But still older vestiges of the days of Dalmatia exist under the waters of the Persian Gulf, and the first Eden lies submerged under the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea.
Okay, yeah, a little reminder. If you knew where to dig,
they found some stuff. Something that they, you know, the dating on it and stuff like that, they were really surprised why it didn't fit there. Because it's like twice as old as anything we
had. Yeah, so there's, I was just going to, that kind of gives me a little predicate for. Just to remind you quickly before we read about the Sumerians here, how much change has happened there at the head of the Persian Gulf. you not only have all the water, you know, the ocean water rising, okay, it's obviously going to change where the coastline is of the Persian Gulf, but over all these millennia, you obviously have lots and lots of sediment pouring out of the mouths of the Tigris and Euphrates, you know, and so the Persian Gulf used to go much more northwest into Iraq than it does now. You know, that whole upper end of it has been filled with mud now, and in those lowlands, southern Iraq now. So when you get into talking about Samaria, and you have these cities like Ur and Erech and those, I mean, they used to be on the coast. Of course, when you're doing archaeological digs now, you're a long ways away from the Persian Gulf. But, you know, the Persian Gulf used to extend much further up. And over all those time, it's filled in. But, you know, we know exactly, like, say, in 5500 B.C., you know, where the Persian Gulf coastline was, and, you know, we can tell that. And sure enough, those cities are all around it right there. You know, there's not just the stuff that, you know, might be under where there's water right now in the Persian Gulf, but there's stuff under all that mud in southern Iraq as well. So, you know, you could be doing digging in southern Iraq there and find stuff, right, without having to go down, you know, actually underwater and find something. So there's that whole complex situation. There's just all kinds of stuff that's going to be buried there with or without water on top of it. Okay. All right. So let's get into the Sumerians here.
Section 8, the Sumerians, last of the Andites. When the last Andite dispersion broke the biologic backbone of Mesopotamian civilization, a small minority of this superior race remained in their homeland near the mouths of the rivers. These were the Sumerians. By 6000 BC, they had become largely Andite in extraction, though their culture was more exclusively Nadite in character, and they clung to the ancient traditions of Dalmatia. Nonetheless, these Sumerians of the coastal regions were the last of the Andites in Mesopotamia, but the races of Mesopotamia were already thoroughly blended by this late date, as is evidenced by the skull types found in the graves of this era.
So just a little reminder there for the archaeologists, don't dig up one of those skulls and go, oh, well, this is what an Andite looked like or whatever. No, I mean, there's a lot of blending. You know, or this is what a Nadite looked like, even, you know, more so. So, yeah, keeping all that in mind, and if you have the full skeleton, you can even tell more. But even just the skull type, you know, will give you hints about this. And we'll eventually get to that where they talk a little bit more about skull shapes. Because humans have loved to fixate on that way of sorting us into bins, whether you're long-headed or round-headed and those sorts of things, right? You know, notice and see, nonetheless, these Sumerians of the coastal regions. Like I was saying, they're not coastal right now. Don't think the current coast in Iraq. Right? Think much more inland back in those days. All right, anything else there? You know, we already talked about how much they're holding on to the Nadite, because it's the holiest of holy places. It's the traditions of Dalmatia. Okay.
It was during the flood times that Susa so greatly prospered. The first and lower city was inundated so that the second or higher town succeeded the floor as the headquarters for the peculiar art crafts of that day. With the later diminution of these floods. Ur became the center of the pottery industry. About 7,000 years ago, Ur was on the Persian Gulf, the river deposits having since built up the land to its present limits. These settlements suffered less from the floods because of better controlling works and the widening mouths of the rivers.
So there you see that I was already referring to it at the very end. There they have very sophisticated channeling of the water going on. And plus it widens. So that helps them, as you were pointing out. We've already talked about all a bit about the river deposits. And, I already kind of hinted at that whole bit, like I said, that there's a long tradition of them scurrying to the east across the Tigris if it just gets too complicated between the rivers. East of Eden thing, right, in the Bible, going over to Elam. And that tradition of those Nodites that went over there long, long, long ago. To Susa, basically. What's now, there in Iran, southwestern Iran. Okay, they're even talking about how, remember how way back, they were moving, they had where Dalmatia was originally, and then they were moving it, because of the change of the ocean and whatnot. So, Susa too has moved, they're pointing out. All right.
The peaceful grain growers of the Euphrates and Tigris valleys had long been harassed by the raids of the barbarians of Turkestan and the Iranian plateau. But now a concerted invasion of the Euphrates Valley was brought about by the increasing drought of the highland pastures. And this invasion was all the more serious because these surrounding herdsmen and hunters possessed large numbers of tamed horses. It was the possession of horses which gave them a tremendous military advantage over their rich neighbors to the south. In a short time, they overran all Mesopotamia, driving forth the last waves of culture, which spread out over all of Europe, Western Asia, and Northern Africa.
As they already gave us the details of just a little bit ago, of course, as we started reading tonight. Like I said, that those barbarians have been coming down from Turkestan for a long time, and it just keeps picking up and picking up. And eventually, you've got full-on horse assault, and it finally just puts an end to it all there between the rivers. And it's notice it's not purely coveting what the rich people have. They start very definitively coveting what the rich people have because it's getting very difficult to eke out a living in an ever drier, drought-stricken land where they are. Because, you eventually in Sinkiang there, you have desert. Right? It used to be wonderful grazing land, for instance. So again, climate is a driving force here. We see our horses here, like we talked about. Let's see, I guess we got everything there. We've already kind of talked about a lot of this in advance. The other thing there. See, you were talking about this, Gene. See the peaceful grain growers? Just that contrast, like they pointed out. These barbarians, are they farmers? No. No, they're hunters and herders. See? All right.
These conquerors of Mesopotamia carried in their ranks many of the better Andite strains of the mixed northern races of Turkestan, including some of the Adamson stock. These less advanced but more vigorous tribes from the north quickly and willingly assimilated the residue of the civilization of Mesopotamia and presently developed into those mixed peoples found in the Euphrates Valley at the beginning of historic annals. They quickly revived many phases of the passing civilization of Mesopotamia, adopting the arts of the valley tribes and much of the culture of the Sumerians. They even sought to build a third Tower of Babel and later adopted the term as their national name.
Okay, see, so even though we're way before Babylonia, at the end, we're in that mode that, you know, that historians don't fully appreciate, you know, they're thinking you have sort of pre-Babylonian Mesopotamia, but not so much so. It's ever more this imported culture and genetic nature coming down from Turkestan that's between the rivers there, as opposed to just an evolving or degrading people that had always been there. Right? We just really don't have, except for down at the very south, much of what had always been there anymore. And so a lot of that recorded history about what's happening in Mesopotamia is not so much Sumerian directly, see, as you might think from the way it's talked about. You know, a lot of it is really this lesser civilization that came in. But, you know, as they pointed out, they have some genetic integrity to them. So they don't come in and go, what is all this crap, and just burn it and destroy it all. They go, oh, this is cool stuff. Let's adopt this. Okay, so they just sort of assumed possession of the cultural vestiges there. You know, kind of lifted themselves up culturally to work with it, you know, as opposed to just burning it because they had no clue what it was for, or they thought it was evil or something because they didn't understand it. All right, so
freaked out by steam.
I'll leave it to you if you're interested to dig around in the historical records about some of this. But it's always interesting to think about what little tidbits they give you here in the book that are designed to give you a little helping hand in reinterpreting what the historians have tried to piece together. Because it's very confusing to them, because it's a very complicated situation that they don't fully understand. So you can take these, what seem to be just sort of simple little statements as you read through here. It's like, okay, well, whatever. But relative to the data that we have, it's very significant to overlay these simple statements upon what we have to properly sort it out and make better sense of what was actually going on there. All right. Let's keep going.
When these barbarian cavalrymen from the northeast overran the whole Euphrates Valley, they did not conquer the remnants of the Andites who dwelt about the mouth of the river on the Persian Gulf. These Sumerians were able to defend themselves because of superior intelligence, better weapons, and their extensive system of military canals, which were an adjunct to their irrigation scheme of interconnecting pools. They were a united people because they had a uniform group religion. They were thus able to maintain their racial and national integrity long after their neighbors to the northwest were broken up into isolated city-states. No one of these city groups was able to overcome the united Sumerians.
Okay, so see, this is something that is not fully appreciated by the scholars, that in those southernmost peoples, they get improperly interpreted relative to the much more definitive city-state phenomenon to the north, to the northwest, you know, precisely, as they're saying there. It looks like you've got, okay, here's another city, and here's another city, so it must be further city-states down here in all the way in the south. But at least way back at this time, no, it was had much more of an integrated nature. And you notice there's even shades of one nation under God, as it were. See? Because they had a uniform group religion. Without that, right, you can, right, I mean, if you aren't unnaturally identifying with genuine unity, don't expect there to be any profound associativity in the external world. Right, so that's what they're reminding you of there. Individuals don't magically associate. Right? Associativity is a superadditive consequence of the relationship between the individual in the outer life and unity in the inner life. There has to be a genuine inner life to some degree. Okay, so you start out, you've got city-states, but and you have cities down in the south there, but you'll see in a minute here, you can put a bow around some of those cities and think of them a little bit more as Sumer rather than this city-state, you know, this city, i.e. this city-state, that city-state, because they aren't quite, at least early on, city-states. They're cities in Sumer. Okay? Let's see. Again, you're seeing like a little bit more about just how complex of a system they had where they... and how sophisticated a defensive militarists they were. They were very effective defensive militarists.
Yeah. Military canals.
You know,
should help you define.
Yeah, like a moat around a right around a castle is a military canal. You know, as it were. But you know, they have obviously you know how. How naturally those rivers, especially the more and more you have a big delta region, you know, get how they just fan out and there's just all kinds of little rivulets going every which direction down in there, so they can start with what's there naturally and just over thousands of years they've obviously built all kinds of sophisticated artificial channeling of all that water down there. And you can kind of see also they they keep hinting there's always been a bias to the Euphrates side of the between the two rivers. So a lot of times they're like, see, let's say about the mouth of the river, about the mouth of the rivers. So like Ur is on the Euphrates side, not on the Tigris side, for instance.
Better weapons, I suppose, are some artifacts.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Right. You just wonder. What you might find, including, remember, how long did metal technology carry forward, against peoples who were Neolithic?
Yeah, I think they had some metal.
remember, in general, it's the Neolithic, but you've got this little asterisks, with the Andites. Like we pointed out, you go over to South America and they're using metals to staple big stones together, it's okay. They're not just purely a Stone Age technology, even though their basic building material might be stones. What else do we have here?
And the invaders from the north soon learned to trust and prize these peace-loving Sumerians as able teachers and administrators. They were greatly respected and sought after as teachers of art and industry, as directors of commerce, and as civil rulers by all peoples to the north, and from Egypt in the west, and to India in the east.
See, isn't it fascinating, the plan that the life carriers had, remember, for the special peoples that were going to be these sort of philosophic leaders, those offspring of of the first generation Adamites and then coming from the prince's staff. There's shades of that that just inescapably keeps coming down through the Nadites all the way to here. You kind of sort of have that happening.
Like they say, almost broken.
So the plan wasn't totally. disrupted. Okay, and I already hinted at that paragraph, right? That they may be barbarian cavalrymen. Did I just say cavalry? Cavalrymen. We always have that tendency to blur those two. But cavalry, cavalry just means horse, yeah. Horsemen. Different from cavalry, which doesn't mean horse. those barbarian cavalrymen, they may have a barbarian culture, but it's they're dumbed down basically. That genetically they could be much more. Right, but their environment and culture dumbed them down, as it were. You put them into a better environment, and they start using some of their genetic gifts a little bit more. And they quickly recognize these Sumerians are handy to keep around. Let's not kill them all. Initially it was probably they wanted to, but when it was so difficult to kill them, they thought, well, on second thought, maybe we ought to keep them around. That's what we wanted to do in the first place, so they didn't have to admit that they couldn't defeat them. Right. You can kind of just hear it playing out historically. Okay, so that's how it ends up. You set this up way back then, and see, that pattern just carried all the way through Babylonia, and kind of past Babylonia proper, even, into what was going on between the rivers in Jesus' time. There was still that north-south differential. Okay.
After the breakup of the early Sumerian Confederation, the later city-states were ruled by the apostate descendants of the Sethite priests. Only when these priests made conquests of the neighboring cities did they call themselves kings. The later city kings failed to form powerful confederations before the days of Sargon because of deity jealousy. Each city believed its municipal god to be superior to all other gods, and therefore they refused to subordinate themselves to a common leader.
Okay, so This didn't last, and we talked before about how difficult it is to keep the unnaturalness of religion going, and eventually natural took over, and they lost the unity, so they lost the associativity, and they broke up into individual city-states. It wasn't until you got a very strong leader came along, could bring them together. And this is a very interesting little tidbit. This is not the Sargon that, if you know anything about history, or even about other things they say in the book, they mention a Sargon. This is neither of those subsequent Sargons. This is not, it's obviously not the Assyrian one, but it's not Sargon of Akkad either. We haven't gotten that far yet. This is an unrecorded Sargon of Kish. And this is the figure that started a very definitive part of recorded history. So that, what they're telling you is those subsequent Sargons are named, after him, a prior Sargon. That we lost, because, like I said, a lot of that stuff didn't get recorded until a long time after, and so the earlier you get the gist of the earlier details, but the specifics are lost and kind of get reworked, re-rationalized. So anyway, that's you don't figure that out initially when you read this. You're thinking it's Sargon, as in the Akkadian Empire. But the more you say, it's like, wait a minute, no, it's not him. This is someone before that. Oh, they're giving us. So the only reason they can tell that to us is because we can't figure that out ourselves. They gave us a little specific tidbit there. Okay. Let's see. Oh, I think we got everything else. Oh, the other thing. Yeah, the apostate descendants of the Sethite priests. That's an interesting way to say it.
What's meant by apostate?
It means that they've basically lost all of their integrity. I mean, a rebel like Lucifer is apostate. They're so disrupted from unity that in a very objective way, you can call them apostate. So that's a very strong word. And they're just, they're using that strong word because a strong word is required to get you to see that when it was no longer one nation under God, so to speak, right, it broke apart.
They were Sethite in name only.
Right. Yeah. They were descendants, but they were completely corrupted. And all their thoughts were about social and political issues and not religious issues. That's why they're apostate. Can you think of anything today where they were one time religious in their thinking and now it's all about social and political issues? Right. See, so if the Revelators wanted to be very precise, they would label most of our religionists today apostate.
Yeah.
Right. Because they've lost all genuine relationship to unity. They've lost all inner life.
The thing you got about trusting God on your coins, yeah, that's about as far as it goes.
Right. We divide and conquer ourselves, as it were, see, by letting go of one nation under God. All right.
The end of this long period of the weak rule of the city priests was terminated by Sargon, the priest of Kish, who proclaimed himself king and started out on the conquest of the whole of Mesopotamia and adjoining lands. And for the time, this ended the city-states, priest-ruled and priest-ridden, each city having its own municipal god and its own ceremonial practices.
So a strong man came in, and that constant battle between the shaman and the chief, okay? Here the chief got the upper hand over the shamans, as it were, and because they had lost all integrity. There was such a tendency for shaman/priests to become just totally debased, throughout all of human history. All right, but you can see, priest of Kish. So this is a more ancient Sargon.
The others were Sargon wannabe.
Yeah, so it's what is now Sargon 1 and Sargon 2, should be Sargon 2 and Sargon 3, as it were, see?
So he was a priest, but he just stuck his head up and said, I'm going to be priest of all of you.
Yeah, I'm going to rise above this whole petty, domain of machinations that you guys have set up, and I'm going to, whip us back into shape here. That's what Muhammad did, right? With the Arabs, same thing.
After the breakup of this Kish confederation, there ensued a long period of constant warfare between these valley cities for supremacy. And the rulership variously shifted between Sumer, Akkad, Kish, Erech, Ur, and Susa.
Yeah, so there you can see them using that kind of collective regional, thing for Sumer. So that you can follow this when you go through the Sumerian kings list. You can, see what they're talking about here, and how it shifts. And but they are giving you that little hint that don't think of it as. Quite as city-state and broken up as you might think. there's still a residual collectiveness. So that instead of saying it went to this city and then that city, you know, kind of, it's going to Sumer, and even Akkad. That's not only a city but a region. You know, so that one you can think of as a generalized term as well there. But Kish and Erech and Ur and Susa. But even Susa, if you look in the King's List, they're kind of using that as a way of indicating anything that's sort of Elam. You know, so you can see that which was to the east of the Tigris, see, was in play in this shifting around. You know, and just after the breakup of this Kish Confederation, I mean, it's strong men die. Unnatural identification with religion fades. I mean, it's very difficult. See, civilization is not natural. Civilization is a choice. I mean, fundamentally, if it's going to endure, the citizens each individually have to choose it. And then that choice gets socialized. No strong man, no benign dictator is going to ultimately save you from your disintegration. Okay? You can see we're getting down there, right, to 2000 BC here.
About 2500 BC, the Sumerians suffered severe reverses at the hands of the northern Suites and...
Or Suits and Goots, how about just go with that?
Suits and Goots. Suits and Goots. Lagash, the Sumerian capital, built on flood mounds, fell. Erech held out for 30 years after the fall of Akkad. By the time of the establishment of the rule of Hammurabi, the Sumerians had become absorbed into the ranks of the northern Semites, and the Mesopotamian Andites passed from the pages of history.
And so you're not all back there in 2500 BC. They're giving you quick little hints there all the way up to Hammurabi, the 18th century BC. You can see how more and more of the outsiders are disrupting this, and it just, if you look in the details, it gets more and more diminished, and it's sputtering, and in kind of longer cycles, and there's sort of a last burst, and then it just fades. Okay.
But at the same time, don't you feel that there's a new evolutionary push coming up from almost, well, it seems like below, you know, an evolutionary. I mean, this is the beginning of what we consider civilization, right? In a sense, recorded history is beginning at this time.
Right, right.
This is when things start to move.
It looks very bleak if you just focus in on, on between the rivers. But we've had millions and millions of Andites that poured forth. And so, eventually there's a latent potential that begins to actualize outside of Mesopotamia. Right. And so, yeah. What was that?
On one hand,
yeah, right.
Yes, if it had been on the other hand, Melchizedek wouldn't have had to come.
Sure.
Right after this.
Yeah, right. But it's not as bleak as it might appear when you just are focusing the story so narrowly geographically. We've kind of talked through, Lagash, there's, is one of those cities that you'll see there in the in the historical records, and they're kind of giving you a little hint about how it has kind of a capital nature, not just a city-state nature, see, to a region, you know, as being the capital of a quote-unquote Sumer, more formally, as opposed to just, you know, there's Ur and there's Lagash and, you know, yada, yada, yada. Okay? All right.
From 2500 to 2000 BC, the nomads were on a rampage from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The Nerites constituted the final eruption of the Caspian group of the Mesopotamian descendants of the blended Andonite and Andite races. What the barbarians failed to do to effect the ruination of Mesopotamia, subsequent climatic changes succeeded in accomplishing.
So, like I said, eventually you end up with what we have in historic recorded history subsequent to 2000 BC is basically Babylonia. You know, which on the one hand you might think is a civilization, but they're reminding you, it's like, oh no, that's nothing compared to what was once between those rivers. Right? You know, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon might sound like a grandiose thing, but not compared to, you know, the kind of culture that once was there. You know, and they love to throw in things like this, like, oh, there's so these people called Nerites. You know, there's many, many, I mean, I've often pointed this out. All through the book, you get peoples and individuals, they toss out a name like this and kind of just leave you scratching. It's like, well, who are those? You know, they apparently are giving a formal name to someone that we could recognize in digging through the records. Oh, we should call those people the Nerites, right?
You Google this?
Right, you know, but yeah, if you try to Google these people, or these individuals, you're not going to find them. They're not there.
It's a tropical mollusk.
Yeah, right there. Yeah, right. Yeah, there is that, yes. Now, it's used biologically, that sequence of letters, yes. Throwing in the suits and the goots there and all these sorts of things. They do that all the time. All right, one last little bit here.
And this is the story of the violet race after the days of Adam and the fate of their homeland between the Tigris and Euphrates. Their ancient civilization finally fell due to the emigration of superior peoples and the immigration of their inferior neighbors. But long before the barbarian cavalrymen conquered the valley, much of the garden culture had spread to Asia, Africa, and Europe, there to produce the ferments which have resulted in the 20th century civilization of Urantia, presented by an archangel of Nebadon.
And before we just let that be the final word, just, you know, reflect for a moment on the things that slipped in there that have such current relevancy. So emigration and immigration are critical issues to civilization? See, we should start talking about that. Oh, wait a minute, we are. We're arguing about that intensely. This is all very relevant. And not only that, that whole bit of how you can kiss civilization goodbye with unfettered immigration of inferior neighbors, and how politically incorrect that statement is, to produce the ferments, agitation. Right? You have this tendency for everything to solidify, to sangikize, you might even say. You need an agitator, you need a disruptor to break that. See, it's right there. That's the incredible thing that the Andites did as they went around the world. They were disruptors. Right? They went into wherever and broke up this false unity, right? This stasis that had set in, right? An establishment. Right, the Andites didn't care about the supposed divinity of the establishment. and they shattered it all over the globe. And that's what kept civilization going. And then when there aren't those that do that, it all just calcifies and ceases to be alive.
Atrophy.
Right. So, yeah, a lot of food for thought right there in those final statements. Not surprisingly, if it's the final paragraph, it probably is hinting at our present situation. You know, and they're saying, all that stuff we just read about, it's not just history, it's relevant. The truth that's flowing through it is relevant to today, the news of today.
And it's funny that we're reading this very thing right now, mm-hmm. at this point in the book.
Again, there's lots of political ignorance in the world, but doesn't mean there can't, just because there's falsehood doesn't mean truth doesn't exist. Don't become a skeptic.
It's amazing how status quo just it gets this religious.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's like I said, it's poor man's unity. It's a false unity thing. And it's just, you have this, these established authorities, and they impose this uniformity of thought and action, and we're a wonderful unified people. No, you're dead. You're frozen. You know, there's a big hammer coming in your future, with guaranteed. It doesn't mean you change, because change without growth is potential evil. Right. You don't just change for change's sake. Right.
But take a good look at it.
But
maybe there's a good reason.
But real truth inexorably produces change, because truth is inherently dynamic. It's not static like an establishment. Right? There's no truth flowing through an establishment. Its stasis proves it. No matter how much it says or believes it's true. Okay. And again, we see the archangel is still writing. Lest you think that that someone that's too down in the weeds and confused about this, you know, hasn't given you a proper accounting of the truth flowing through it. Someone at a very high level is telling you the truth of the Sumerians, for instance. As opposed to a midwayer, you know, that was actually living at the time. Okay? All right. On to looking at where the Andites went. So we'll do the Orient first, as I hinted at the beginning. And we've got to see what happened in Xinjiang, for instance, right off the bat. Okay, let's take a moment, everyone.